Hey, Jim. Thanks so much for coming on to the podcast. I really appreciate it. Hope you're doing well. Really excited to do this with you.
Things are here good, Nick. Always glad to do this. Ton of fun.
All right, so let's jump right into it with Nadal's forehand. So let's start with the grip. I think over the years there's been much debate over which grip Nadal uses on his forehand. Could you give us clarification on exactly what grip he uses?
You know, just looking at video, I've never been able to stand next to Nadal, obviously, on court and look at it. But looking at it on video and some up-close stuff over the year, to me, it's clearly on a semi-Western. You know, a lot of people think that it's on a Western because of the spin that he gets. But in my opinion of looking at grips for 35 years and a pretty good job, I can be five courts away from someone and pretty much nail the grip that you've got. And I would tell you that he is, I would be confident telling you he's on a semi-Western.
For someone who does not have years of coaching experience like you, is there a way that someone could identify his grip on TV, or are there signals that they could look for in his swing, or anything else that might, you know, help them identify that?
You know, I think this one is one of the toughest ones because of how there are things that you can look for, but he has such a unique way of taking the racket back where he cocks that racket back over the top of his own head. It almost looks like he comes close to touching the top of his head with the back of his racket as he turns.
Mm-hmm.
And just puts the racket at such an odd angle that it's not an easy grip just to say, hey, it's this. If you were looking at a Federer, if you were looking at a Djokovic, which is a cleaner take back, you would just look at the angle of the racket face. Mm-hmm. The way you look at the grips is you want to see where the base knuckle of the index finger is. But at 30, 40 feet, it's pretty tough to do that. So you have to start to look at the angle of the racket face on the way back. And in most players, I think that's pretty easy to do. With Nadal's, it's a little trickier because the angle to his racket face is nowhere near a traditional take back. So you're looking for the angle of the racket face when you can't identify the knuckle.
And we're talking about the angle of the racket face during the backswing, right?
During the backswing, correct.
Right.
So you can also look at the bottom of the swing to see mm-hmm. how close the face is. But basically, the angle of the racket face on the way back is going to tell you much of what you need to know.
Got it. So before the podcast started, you know, we were chatting about how if Nadal had a more extreme grip, you know, it would have limited his success on other surfaces. Would you mind elaborating on that?
Sure. I think your best example of that would be like a Gustavo Quirin. The guy won, if I remember right, three French Opens. And then, you know, I think the best he ever did in a Wimbledon tournament was probably a quarterfinal, something like that, round of 16. I don't ever remember him getting gone, you know, to a semifinal and clearly not a final. So when you have those extreme grips to go from grass to clay is difficult, especially further back when someone like he was on grass, the bounce was lower, a little bit quicker. And I know they've changed the grass a little bit. It's a little more of a hybrid, but still it's a quick surface. The bounce does not accommodate a severe grip because the bounce is going to be lower. So if Nadal had that extreme grip, I do not think that he would have had success on the grass as he has. I mean, the guy won Wimbledon, so you don't get any better than that.
Absolutely. Yeah, looking at Cureton's results now, he had very limited success at Wimbledon. I mean, he had first round, he made one quarterfinal, but then third round, second round, and outside of the times he won the French Open, I mean, he pretty much did not perform that great at the other majors.
No, even the Australian Open, the US Open.
Yeah.
He did not do well.
His lifetime record at the French Open was 36-8, and at the Australian Open it was 7-8, which is a pretty crazy difference.
That is definitely a drastic difference from right. surfacing.
Okay, let's get back to Nadal. So what are the key elements to Nadal's swing path that we can discuss in this audio format?
Well, the five things that anyone has to have to hit topspin is, first, you have to have racket speed. Next, you have to have a closed racket face where the strings on the downswing are tilted to the ground. Some players tilt the racket more severely. The more severely you tilt the racket, the more vertical the upswing has to be to get the racket face vertical at the contact point. You've got racket speed. You've got a closed racket face. You've got to be able to swing from below the ball to above the ball. I kind of break that down into three and four. I have a debate with my good friend Ryan Reedy at 2MinuteTennis.net. He always says it's four things. I always say it's five. He kids me that I count to five on this. But I think it's five, because just because you get below the ball does not mean you swing above the ball. I get people who get the racket below the ball, but they don't swing up like they should. They swing across. So I break it down into five things: racket face, the racket speed, the closed racket face. You've got to be able to get below the ball, swing above the ball, and you do those four things for the all-important vertical racket face at the contact point. And you've got a small margin of error at the contact point. Doesn't have to be perfectly vertical, but out of 360 degrees in a circle, you better be within 1, 2, 3, 4 degrees of vertical to make that ball behave the way that you want it. Looking at high-speed film of Nadal, again, this is no scientific approach, but looking at high speed, looking at the angle of his racket face, I think he gets past vertical more than anyone else that I have seen. Where Vic Bragan used to talk about you have to be within 1 or 2 degrees of vertical at the contact point to make the ball behave with topspin and make it go over the net and land in, I think that Nadal probably gets a little past that 1 or 2 degrees. But again, out of 360 degrees in a circle, he's not far off those 1 or 2s that that Vic talked about years ago.
And when you're talking about vertical, you're meaning the racket needs to be perpendicular to the ground at contact.
Right. The strings need to be facing forward to the net. So if you put your racket on a wall, your strings would lay flat against the wall.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to achieve that at the contact point. And really, you know, that's why the great players are great. The Serenas, the Nadals, Federers, you know, you just go on and on. The Djokovic's, Chris Evert, go back to any time, is they had the ability to get the racket face vertical more than anybody else that they played. And that's what made them great.
So when you're saying that Nadal's racket is more the past vertical than others, are you saying up or down?
I would be slightly down.
Right.
Brings it a little bit just a tiny bit more closed than I would never be able to get my racket tilted at the angle that Nadal gets and be able to get the ball over the net. I don't have the swing speed to do it, and I don't have the vertical swing to do it.
So for someone listening who might be wondering, okay, so even if your strings are facing slightly down, even if we're talking about a few degrees, how exactly does the ball go over if the strings are down?
Because of the upward swing and the racket speed. That's what it is. That counters the fact that the string might be slightly past vertical, is that you've got that lift from the racket, that low to high swing.
Got it.
And someone like Nadal, I mean, his swing speed is just off the charts. I mean, that comes down to genetics. I'm not going to be able to swing the racket as fast as Nadal, and probably no one that's listening to this podcast will be able to swing their racket as fast as Nadal.
Right.
It definitely takes those elite athletes.
Can you explain the importance of what Nadal's lower body is doing in him achieving his ideal forehand?
Sure. I mean, for any great forehand, you need to be able to push away from the ground to achieve that racket speed. So that's just ground reaction force. You pushing away from the ground pushes back. And when that happens, you can generate a lot of speed. And I will tell the kids, you know, you want to push away from the ground, from your toes to your nose, through your racket swing. And if your body's going up at the right time with the racket, you're in sync, you generate more power if you're pushing away from the ground than if you're just swinging from your arm. Now, a lot of coaches, and you'll hear commentators, and it just drives me nuts when they see a player hit the ball and the player doesn't lift with their lower body, and they go, see how they stayed down. And they're telling millions of people who are watching to stay down when they hit the ball. But if you took 100 forehands and the player was not in trouble, you would see them lifting with their lower body. But the commentator wants to pick out that one time where you see Serena is in an impossible position. She can't lift with her legs. She uses the arm and some body rotation to get her racket speed. She makes the shot. It's unbelievable. And the commentator, as I said, picks on that one shot. Goes, oh, see, the pros don't lift like they used to. And it's not true. Look at more than just one shot, and you'll find that you need that push away from the ground to generate that racket speed that they do.
I mean, for Nadal in particular, the complete opposite in the sense of he pushes so much into the ground that Vic Braden would argued that it was going. He predicted, I should say, that it was going to cause him injury over his career.
He did. Vic was always able to look, down the road, kick the can down the road further than other people. And I remember having a conversation with him when he was at our club. We were talking about Nadal and Federer, and Nadal was relatively young at that time. And his thought was Nadal was going to have more lower body injuries than Federer because of how violently Nadal pushed away from the ground. He said the amount of force that he was pushing into the ground, and if I remember right, it's been a long time, but the G's that he was going to pull was like 3 or 4 times his body weight, where Federer was less than that.
Is that also impacted by the fact that Federer steps into the court more, plays more neutral stance, whereas Nadal is generally playing more open stance?
I've never heard that. It's a possibility. I won't ever go into a lane that I don't know. It's definitely possible. But when I look at someone who has a neutral stance or someone who has an open stance, anytime I've looked at it, they both lift. Mm-hmm. I think Nadal is just, he's an athletic freak of nature on the court. I mean, the guy's just amazing. His athleticism and his power. He definitely pushes off the ground hard. If you look at Nadal in practice sessions, and you look at Nadal, this is a little off the topic of pushing away from the ground, but you look at him in practice sessions and then play. I literally went through, watched a practice session, but I just want to see how many times in a practice session he does the so-called reversed follow-through over his head. And I was 4 minutes into his practice session before he did one. Then I was 19 minutes into the practice session before he did the second
one. Oh, my gosh.
And people don't realize that when and how often when he's practicing, he steps into the ball. He definitely, as he's playing a match, that racket speed increases, his opponent's racket speed, he starts to use that open or that partially open stance, and then you start to see that follow-through come out. Anyone listening to the podcast, just go watch Nadal in a practice setting and watch where he finishes. And you're going to go, oh my gosh, that's Roger Federer. Finishes in the same place that Roger Federer does.
So you got to my next question. So I wanted to talk more about this finish that Nadal commonly utilizes during matches, but as you said, he does not utilize it as much during practice. So what benefits does this reverse forehand, and can you explain to someone who might not even know what we're talking about, what the reverse forehand is?
So the traditional follow-through, if you're right-handed, would finish over your left shoulder, or if you look at a Federer, finishes below and outside his left shoulder. But if you're right-handed, it finishes on the left side. If you're left-handed, it would finish on the right side of your body. But if you watch Nadal, he will quite often finish over the top of his head, and his racket will come back over to the same side of his body where he started. So, again, I talked to Vic about this one time, and he didn't think that and I agreed even before the conversation started, was Nadal's follow-through is not that unique. It really isn't. Go back and look at Bjorn Borg. Watch how many times he had a reverse follow-through. He did. I love watching the old matches. And Borg would finish with his racket in, quote, what we call a reverse follow-through now. If you go look at Michael Chang, I say that guy got to that reverse follow-through because he was so fast to the ball. He got to some balls that I think most players couldn't get to. He's in an awkward position. He might be a little bit late hitting the ball. So you see that reverse follow-through. Lindsay Davenport, I think hers was the opposite. She was one of the slowest players who played tennis. She was late getting to the ball, and she would have that reverse follow-through. I don't think it's as uncommon as people think it is. And when you really watch Nadal's reverse follow-through, you got to watch it in slow motion. Take a look at when it starts. Ryan at 2MinuteTennis.net, we just talked about it, and he was just doing a little comparison of Federer and Nadal, and he looked at their swing path, and he was surprised between Federer and Nadal, the swing path was the same through the hitting zone. And then once it cleared through the hitting zone, Federer finished over the left side, and Nadal finished up over the top of his head. But if you really watch during that area of the swing, they're almost identical. Nadal, I don't think, really finishes over the top of his head in most situations because he's late. I just think that's where he likes to finish. But you can watch Federer finish over the top of his head. You can watch Nadal in a match finish over his outside his right shoulder. So they're not consistently using the exact same finish over and over again. Yes, you could identify that they're using this finish more often than other finishes, but you take all of the players, they're all using a different finish at different times, just like they don't all use an open stance. They don't all use a closed stance or a neutral stance. They use every stance that they need when they get to that ball to make the best shot that they can. And I think coaches get caught up into a Nadal's follow-through or a Federer's follow-through. And if you really look at it, I can show you Federer finishing like Nadal and Nadal finishing like Federer. What I'm most interested in is that area, a foot before the contact point and a foot after the contact point. That area where the racket is vertical, I want a foot before that and a foot after that. And once you get past that foot after your contact point, I mean, for the most part, you can finish between your knees because the ball is already long gone. So the finish to me is less important than everything you did up into the finish.
Does Nadal's reverse forehand, I mean, we're comparing it to Federer. Federer's got that finish that's over the lower than the shoulder and on the outside of the arm. Does the higher follow through that Nadal executes allow him to increase the upward angle of his swing or swing faster, generate more topspin?
I don't think it necessarily allows him to swing faster. I mean, if you look at Nadal's forehand and Federer's forehand, their racket speed, I'm sure it's within very close miles per hour of each other.
Mm-hmm.
The upward swing, absolutely higher over the net. Upward swing gives you an increase of topspin. And Nadal, from the stats I've seen, Nadal hits on average higher over the net than just about any other player on the tour. I know that Thiem gets a lot of racket speed as well and gets a lot of ball rotation. I don't know if his height over the net is as much as Nadal's, but Nadal's height over the net definitely gets his opponents in more trouble because he can get their contact point up a little higher than what they're used to. So definitely his finish does help him get a little bit more height, a little bit more rotation on the ball.
So when Ryan compared these two forehands, and he found Federer and Nadal, and he found them to be pretty similar, what exactly was he talking about?
He was just talking about the angle of the upward swing.
Ah.
And they were in fact the one he looked at again, but it's very difficult. You look at one,
right?
That's interesting, but you really need to look at 100.
Yes,
Look at 100, find out exactly what it is, but you're going to find out it's not that much difference.
Hmm.
You're not going to find 10 or 15 degrees difference between a Federer and a Nadal. You're going to find out that it's minimal.
That's really surprising. Okay, so we kind of already touched on this, but you know, talking about how Nadal generates so much topspin and height on his shots. So I guess another question related to the reverse forehand would be, do other players seem to play it more often when they're late or they're on the run, whereas Nadal seems to play it in those situations, but also just as a general standard, you know, neutral forehand or even when he's being more aggressive? Why would someone like Nadal or others use the reverse forehand when they're late as opposed to the regular finish?
Right. So I always ask my students, if you're late, how fast do you have to swing to now become on time? And they'll ponder that question. And I always think it's kind of funny because once you're late, you can't swing fast enough to be on time. You're already late. So it's a little bit of a trick question. So what experienced players do, you would do it, I've seen you do it on the court as well, Nick, is when you realize at this point, look, I'm already late. I can't swing fast enough to now be on time. You're supposed to be there at the party at 7 o'clock, and at 7:01, driving faster isn't going to help. You're less late, but you're still late. So the pros figure out a long time ago. And again, go back and watch a Bjorn Borg hit this shot. You go back further than that and find players doing it. Once they're late, they realize that increasing the upward swing is their salvation. That's what's going to help them get the racket vertical. That's what's going to help them get the lift over the net. Probably the idea of hitting higher over the net to buy themselves some more time, try to get the ball deep into the backcourt. So that's what you're trying to do. Once you realize that you're going to be late, you start to swing up more steeply to get that vertical racket face. I would go back and say another reason I think Nadal hits higher over the net than other players is because Nadal wants to hit the ball higher over the net than other players. I think he has figured out through trial and error that giving them that ball definitely gets him the result that he wants. If you went out and asked Roger Federer to hit higher over the net like Nadal, guaranteed he could do it. But I don't think Federer's game, he does that. He has a different approach to the game. So I think one of the reasons that Nadal hits higher over the net is just desire and tension. He likes it. He's found out that it pays him dividends. Federer could do the same thing if you asked him to.
Got it. So it seems like the lateness, if a player is late, you know, if Nadal is rushed to his forehand side, you know, there has been times in the past where Djokovic has really been able to rush him to the forehand side, and he'll obviously use the reverse finish, and the ball ends up being shorter. Do you think that's related to the reverse finish?
Sure, but at that point, if we're talking Nadal is in a position where he's in trouble, again, I ask my students all the time, and they always ponder this question. I kind of get a giggle out of it, is I ask them, if Nadal's in trouble, he's in an emergency situation, does the level of play go up or down? And they'll think about it. I have a group of people on the court who look at each other and have a little discussion, and I'm just like, guys, his level of play goes down. Nobody's level of play goes up when they're in trouble.
Right.
You're in trouble. Nadal doesn't want to be in trouble. And so when he has that vertical swing and he's in trouble, he's thrilled that the ball got back over the net. He would much rather make the player make one more shot than him make the unforced errors. I'll ask my student that question. What would you rather do, make the unforced error or make your opponent hit the winner? And again, people think about it. It's really an obvious answer. You don't want to hit the unforced error. Make your opponent hit the winner, because they may make the mistake for you. How many times have we seen that on the pro tour? Someone's got a sitter and they blow it. But if you make the unforced error, you have no chance of winning the point. So in that situation, and Nadal is going, look, at least I'm going to make Djokovic hit one more ball.
Right.
He's either going to go for it outright, or he's going to put the ball back into play. Maybe he can get to the next ball. Probably not. But at least he's going to make Djokovic play one more ball. And that upward swing, that reverse follow through, you're a little bit late. Gives you the height over the net. You make your opponent play one more ball. Sometimes it works out for you.
That makes sense. Okay, so earlier we touched upon Nadal's backswing. So can you describe how Nadal's backswing has evolved over time?
There's video online of Nadal hitting when he was 14, 15 years old. He takes the racket back, how I teach all of my students to take the racket back, when he was 14, 15 years old. Over time, his racket has definitely, the path of his backswing has definitely changed. I've looked at video online. I would also tell you, I think his grip when he was a teenager was much closer to an Eastern than the semi-Western that it is now. So I like his old swing better than his new swing. I would use his swing when he was a young teenager as a role model on how to hit a forehand. I would not teach anyone Nadal's swing now. That's unique. When he takes the racket back and his strings point to the sky, and he has to bring the racket back almost the opposite direction. So he points it over his head. Now he's got to make that correction. Any correction that you have to make prior to hitting the ball just sets you up for errors. But the guy is a phenomenal athlete. When coaches teach tennis, they need to not teach those things that are idiosyncrasies to a player that's special to that player. What we should be doing is teaching those things that all of the players do that are alike. And that's the five things we talked about earlier. And what you want is the most efficient swing with the least amount of parts. You don't want the swing that has just the least amount of parts and not the most efficient swing. An example would be McEnroe had a very simple, efficient swing. Put the racket straight down on both sides, didn't reset his racket, strings out to his target. Granted, it had a continental grip, but still the swing was very simple. But it wasn't the most efficient. He couldn't generate the racket speed that he needed. So McEnroe understood he needed to go forwards to the net because he wasn't going to beat Lindell from the baseline, because Lindell was just going to have too much racket speed. So we want it to be efficient. We want it to have the least amount of parts. Nadal's swing is not the most efficient. It doesn't have the least amount of parts. He's got extra stuff in there that you would not want to teach your student. Most of the pros on the tour have things in their swing that you don't want your students to have, because your student is most likely not, don't want to offend anybody, is not a world-class athlete. How many Nadals are there in the world? One. How many Federers, Serenas, Graffs, Everetts? I mean, they're just so far and few in between. I think when we teach our students to be like the pros on TV, we do them a disservice. Because you need, if you're going to have those extra parts, you better be a world-class athlete to handle those extra parts.
Where do you think this extra move on Nadal's forehand came from?
That's the one question, Nick, that I wish I had an answer for. I would love to know someone far more intelligent than, or more experienced, intelligent than I am, would have to answer that question, to be honest with you. I have looked at these players, and I do not understand why they change their swings from time to time. You can look at Federer. Federer's got different looks on his serve over the years. It's not drastic, but there's definitely a difference in Federer's serve over the years. Nadal, I think his swing at 14 was more efficient than it is at, what, he's 35 now, something like that?
34.
34? Why these things happen, I have no idea. A neuroscientist or someone, a sports psychologist, would be better off to answer that question.
So he's changed this swing, but he's still able to win plenty of Grand Slams. So is the reality that, one, he's a world-class athlete, and not only is he a world-class athlete, but he's Nadal. But also, there's only, despite this little hitch that he has in his swing, there's only a few players that are able to actually take advantage of it?
And it's the other two world-class players who are in a category all their own.
So right.
You also have to throw in hard work. The guy believes in himself. It's not just that he's a world-class athlete. Clearly, there have been world-class athletes who didn't have the work ethic. This guy's just a workhorse. And he doesn't seem to really get upset. I think he's one of the most mentally tough players of all time. You rarely see him lose his temper. He bounces back from a big loss very quickly. And he, when they ask him about it, he says, yeah, Federer, same thing. Yeah, I'm over it in like 5 or 10 minutes.
Right.
They asked Federer when he lost to Del Potro at Indian Wells, where I think he had 3 match points in the third set, and they had that little tiff at the net.
Right.
Federer ends up losing it, and they asked him later on, and he said, you know, usually it takes me, you know, 10, 15 minutes to get over a match, and this one's going to take a little longer. So for him, it was probably 24 or 48 hours, something like that.
Right.
And those guys seem to be able to forget a loss more than your, you know, even your top 20 or 30 player in the world. I think, hands down, Andy Roddick, arguably one of the most mentally tough players of all time. I would put him at the top of my list. That guy lost to Federer over and over again, and he showed up fighting every single time. There was never a time we did not see Andy Roddick fight. And after that many losses to the same guy, over time, you would kind of go, man, how do you fight like that every time? And again, I think that's just genetics. Those are the gifts, and that's why we are willing to pay lots of money to see these people play.
100%. Yeah, that's a great point about Roddick. And I mean, I feel like Federer, to a certain extent, had the same issue with Nadal, and just losing to Nadal so many times. Obviously, he had more wins over Nadal than Roddick had over Federer. But it is definitely mentally draining to lose to the same person over and over. So would you say that because of this hitch in Nadal's swing, would you say that has a role to play in Nadal's success at the French Open? Or I guess the way the question should be phrased, is it harder for opponents like Federer and Djokovic to attack Nadal on the slower surfaces?
I think, you know, that's a great question. I don't know if I could truly answer that. I'm never going to BS my way through a question.
Sure.
That hitch, you would think that it would be a challenge for Nadal, that it would be able to be exploited. But the slow bounce on the clay, you know, the ball's moving through the air just as fast, but once it hits the court surface, the ball's going a little slower, so that hitch is not going to be as a big deal as it would be on the grass.
Right.
So I think you would take advantage of that hitch, and I think the grass would just do it for you. If you were an attacking player on grass, that hitch would definitely cause Nadal more problems than it would on clay. But just look at how many clay court French Opens that Nadal has won. I think he's got 11. You always know the stats better than I do.
I mean, now, I think, what is he at now? I think he's at 13 now.
Oh my gosh, at 13. And then how many Wimbledons? One?
No, two? He's won Wimbledon twice.
Twice, so he's got two. Yep. And then the rest of his Grand Slam, so that's 13, 14, 15.
Yeah, he's won the U.S. Open 4 times, and he's won right. The Australian Open once.
Right.
So that's 20.
You can clearly tell that hitch becomes a problem as the court surface gets faster.
Yeah.
And you could argue that if he didn't have that hitch, would he have 25 slams now? And what? He was out for almost 2 years with injuries. If he wasn't out for those 2 years, he didn't have the hitch, what are we talking, 30 slams?
in you know, there's only one clay court slam every year. If there was two clay court slams instead of two hard court slams, then
oh my gosh,
he would be way ahead of Federer and Djokovic. We wouldn't even be close.
Untouchable. I would love it. I think it would be. It can't be done, obviously, but I would love to see Nadal's 13-year-old forehand. 14-year-old forehand, his young teenage forehand, be his forehand today.
Mm-hmm.
I think on those other surfaces, he would be a better player.
Yep. I have always thought that his best playing style is when, you know, he's combining his more defensive oriented game with first strike tennis.
I will tell you, I think, and I know off topic of his forehand, but go back and look at his backhand. He used to take his racket back high on his backhand side.
Yep.
He got more racket speed. So, and at this game, racket speed is pretty darn important. And now he takes the racket back, low. And I think someone like Djokovic, who takes his racket back high on both sides, is a better matchup against Nadal than Nadal is against Djokovic. I think if Nadal had the take back high on both sides, he'd be able to generate racket speed off that backhand side, very much like he can do off his forehand side. But he loses a good amount of racket speed on his backhand because he takes it down low. But early on in his career, his racket was high on both sides. Why these players make these changes always is a mystery, because it definitely did not make his backhand better, not in my opinion.
Right. Yeah, that's a pretty interesting comment about Djokovic comparing his backhand to Nadal's, given that Nadal has a much lower take back, and you're right, you know, his backswing on both sides, forehand and backhand, looked much more similar at the beginning of his career.
Yes.
It looked like almost carbon copy of each other.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, this was great, Jim. I really appreciate you coming on and providing these wonderful insights on Nadal's forehand.
Anytime. It's always, you ask great questions. You always probe into some really good areas.
All right. Well, I'm sure we'll do this again soon with some of the other shots from the big three, and I really look forward to doing that.
Anytime, Nick. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Of course.